We treat these people, these economic refugees, as if they're zombies from The Walking Dead. We have to deal with this problem humanely and with compassion. These are not invaders. For goodness sake, I can't. We suspend our humanity when it comes to this issue, and I fear that it is because they look different than the man.
Geraldo Rivera there reacting to the weekend's tear gassing of migrants at the border. So what does our treatment of migrants tell us about how we view humanity and who's deserving of it? Many of us are taught that the United States is a beacon for human rights, but our history, starting well before today, suggests that not only may we be failing in that mission, but we have in the past. So how do our standards around human rights align with our actions? To help us make sense of this is Zach Cheney Rice, a staff writer with Intelligencer for New York Magazine. Hi, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
And Samuel Moyne, a professor of law and history at Yale. Samuel, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Zach, I want to start with you. You wrote a piece for New York Magazine that focused on what we were just talking about, the images of children being tear gassed at the border. You, in your piece, said that this is a deliberate tactic that's been used in the past. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so I think that we have to understand what happened at the border this weekend in the context of protest in part. These people have increasingly narrow legal avenues through which to seek asylum, and the crackdown that was in response to their agitating against the border policy and in some cases trying to rush the border, you know, that's part of this follows a long history of children being used as sort of collateral in crackdowns on protest. And the example that I used in my piece was the Birmingham Children's Crusade during the Civil Rights Movement, where, you know, violence against children enacted by Bull Connor, you know, lacerating their flesh with fire hoses and beating them with batons and sicking police dogs on them. These were all meant to serve as deterrents against people demanding human rights and people whose claims to citizenship were very precarious, if not being denied outright. In that case, it was Black Americans. Today, it's migrants from Central America mostly, and it's a pretty clear reflection of a pattern that's been enacted throughout our history.
Samuel, I want to bring you in here. When we talk about migrants making their way to the United States, how is that, and what do we mean in terms of that being a human rights story? And what are we missing in that conversation?
Well, I think we should first recognize that there's a very limited human right to asylum. In human rights law, you have the right to leave your country, but not to enter any other, even if you have pressing economic need. Only if you have a well-founded fear of persecution, which some of these migrants say they have based on gangs at home, for example, can you enter another country? The trouble is that the right is so narrow, and the United States historically has tried to avoid granting it, and that's what it's doing now.
It's tried to avoid granting it because?
Well, because of a long history in which it's welcomed a lot of people, but also tried to keep a lot of others at bay, especially when they're the wrong color. That's a history that goes back a long time.
Right. And that's something I'm thinking, you know, we've often talked about the United States, said this at the top of the show, as being this beacon of freedom. I want to talk a little bit about where these notions come from historically, Samuel.
So it's true that the United States was founded on the idea of human rights and the Declaration of Independence. But from the beginning, that meant kicking out a lot of people on the wrong side of the revolution, clearing the land of Native Americans, enslaving Blacks. And then in the late 19th century, we set up pretty strict immigration controls in the face of Asian migration that have lasted more or less to the present, with some periods of greater generosity. And so the United States is founded on human rights, but also has a mixed record in recognizing the idea that all kinds of people may deserve to enter.
Zach, when you saw the images of mothers and other people running from what's essentially a chemical attack, what were some of the first thoughts that came to mind?
Well, I think initially you have to look at this from a strategic standpoint on the part of the Trump administration. I think that for the past few weeks, Trump and his allies in the Republican Party and conservative media have done their best to gin up as much fear as possible around the approaching migrant caravan from Honduras. And part of that was casting these people without any evidence as criminals and terrorists overwhelmingly when, you know, all reporting was to the contrary. We saw that there were several small children being brought by their mothers, and these were, for all intents and purposes, and from what anybody could really tell, these were just people fleeing violence in Central America and seeking economic opportunity in the United States. But the Trump administration, I think, for weeks has been conditioning us for violence against these people by casting them as an imminent threat to the United States. So when I saw the tear gassing of these people and their children, it seemed like a pretty logical culmination of that strategy to make us conditioned and make us prepared emotionally for violence against these people. And I think that's part of why it's been allowed to go on as long as it has, starting with the child separation policies and even before, and continuing to this weekend.
Samuel, I want to ask you also, there's a really important point that Zach just brought up, really about rhetoric coming from the administration, also coming from the media and its choice of language. When we think about history and in the United States' record, if you will, which we sort of touched on earlier on who we let out and who we let in, how much does rhetoric have to do with that and ginning up that type of fear of the other?
Everything. History shows that whatever moral standards we may say we believe in the end, if hatred is whipped up, it will prevail. And it really long has. We're seeing things that are worse right now, but Barack Obama's presidency involves some use of tear gas and pepper spray at the border. One silver lining, if you can find one in the current situation, is that because of the current president, we're looking much more closely at the brutality of the government at the border and elsewhere. And the question is whether you can change culture and rhetoric. It seems easier to whip up a frenzy against otherness than to show that people are not criminals and terrorists and that they do have at least this narrow right to make their case to enter.
You know, I'm wondering, too, given the history of the United States, of our country, Zach, you wrote about this in your piece. You know, we're here in 2018. Why have we fallen back into a lot of these patterns? I mean, are they just ingrained in who we are as Americans? This issue that, you know, we can't seem to get to a place where we don't look at refugees, migrants, brown people, poor people as the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to be specific about who we're talking about. I think the Trump administration, at least its attitude towards immigration, has expressed a pretty explicitly white nationalist project where national identity is sort of cemented by narrowly defining who belongs in the United States and who does not. And that has, for, you know, the past several years under Trump, largely hinged and revolved around this idea of the sort of traditional white understanding of American citizenship.
But why do we keep falling for it, though, Zach? That's the thing. Like, I don't know why most Americans seem to keep falling for this.
I think it's incredibly appealing to a lot of people. I think especially in times of uncertainty, especially in times where I think a major component of why it's happening now is demographic change and a sense of a sort of changing sense of who has visibility and who has power in the United States, which substantially hasn't changed that dramatically. But the optics are that these people have had to watch a black man in the White House for the past 8 years. They've seen more and more non-white children being born in the United States. They've seen what they understand as a much more generous immigration policy, letting in a lot of different looking people. And I think that scares people. And I think, you know, paired with a lot of other struggles that they might be going through on a day-to-day basis, it's easy and it's a simple answer to scapegoat people who aren't here already. It's a simple answer to scapegoat immigrants. It's a simple answer to scapegoat minorities. And I think that this is a constant throughout United States history, and I don't know that it ever won't be.
And at the same time, Samuel, we talk about the United States where it's ingrained in us as since we're kids about how we are the land of the free. We stand up for human rights here and around the world. And yet this is our current practice. These ideas seem to be in direct opposition and contradiction. Could you help us understand that?
Well, it's tough to explain, but we have to go back to the fact that the idea of human rights for Americans meant founding a nation for whites. And the very idea that America could be a place honoring diverse identities and diverse colors is very recent. And when people are anxious about things in their lives, it's common to scapegoat them. Sadly, the alt, not just in the United States, has played on fears of migrant caravans going back 30 years. And this is perfect for those who really want to divert us from whatever the real issues are that concern people and lead them to project their fears on others who are not dangerous. In the end, the United States has been welcoming on and off. And the question is how we get our fellow citizens to look past their fears and see other parts of the traditions they've slowly learned to see other people as humans and potentially fellow citizens.
Samuel Moyne is a professor of law and history at Yale, and Zach Cheney Rice is a staff writer with Intelligencer for New York Magazine. Thanks to you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is Terry Mintz from Bend, Oregon. Slavery, misogyny, the Trail of Tears, religious intolerance, the Japanese internment. I could go on and on naming the ways in every decade that this country failed to live up to its promise to be a beacon of human rights. But this country was conceived and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, and the Statue of Liberty plaque contains the words by which we should raise this country and make it, for the first time in its history, great.
My name is Mark from San Juan Capistrano. Basic human rights in America right now? Absolutely not. And the apparent evidence is with the practice of gerrymandering voting districts and excluding minorities from being able to vote.
This is Andrea Hollander in Portland, Oregon. Now our country's actions and resulting reputation in regards to human rights have taken a huge plunge.
Join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.